Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's best arts and cultural stories. I am Netta Ulibi. This week on Culturetopia, a report on New Orleans Mardi Gras Indians seeking to copyright their famous costumes, the influence of South Florida's topography on the author of the new novel Swamplandia, and NPR's Bob Mondello on Julie Taymor's much-reviled Broadway spectacle Spider-Man: Turn Off the Dark. But first,
when 94-year-old Maria Altman died on Monday, she left not only grieving relatives and friends, she also left a legal legacy, one that may, in the future, help families right a decades-long injustice. NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates has her story.
Maria Altman died in Los Angeles, but she was born in Vienna when the city was a flourishing center of the arts. She told NPR in 1998 her aunt, Adela Bloch-Bauer, was at the center of it all.
She was a patron of Gustav Klimt, who painted her portraits, and she died at age 42, and there was a memorial room in the palais of my uncle where all the Klimts were, and the house was full of beautiful artwork, so I grew up with it.
Altman lived in luxury until the eve of World War II. She fled the Nazis, who commandeered her family's home and all of its possessions, including what's become one of Gustav Klimt's most famous paintings, a Klimt portrait of her aunt, now valued at more than $130 million. After the war, Altman visited the painting as it traveled in exhibitions, but despaired of ever having it returned to her family.
I had given up all hope, and so did my sister and brother, who unfortunately deceased by now.
When Austria passed a law in 1998 that allowed heirs to looted estates to press for their belongings to be returned, Altman tried again. No luck. Some of Altman's family possessions had been returned, but the family had had to give up rights to several important paintings in order to get the rest out of the country. The late Hubertus Czernin, an Austrian journalist who wrote about his country's looted art holdings, put it bluntly to NPR in 1998.
This was, in my point of view, a classical case of blackmailing. They had no chance and no choice.
Maria Altman decided to enlist the help of a young family friend, lawyer Randy Schoenberg.
It's unusual to find a case this long after the initial taking that is so large and not properly resolved.
Schoenberg, himself a child of Holocaust survivors and president of LA's Museum of the Holocaust, based his case on 1976 U.S. law that says sovereign entities do not have absolute immunity when they appropriate U.S. citizens' property. And the law was retroactive. Schoenberg took the case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court and won. The next step, he told Altman, should be arbitration in Vienna.
And she said, "Are you crazy? We just went all the way up to the Supreme Court and back. Why would we ever want to go back and have the case decided in Austria?" And I said, "Maria, if you want the case decided in your lifetime, we have to take this chance and do it."
To many people's shock, the arbitration panel agreed the painting should be returned. Michael Basler, an expert on Holocaust restitution law at Chapman University Law School, says the Austrians should be given credit for that decision.
Austria could have just said, "So what? We're not going to comply with it." They did comply with it.
A very satisfied Maria Altman was present when they arrived.
The biggest triumph for me is that they have to admit publicly now how everything that they said was not true.
The portrait of Adela Bloch-Bauer is on display in a small museum in New York, a city with one of the country's largest Jewish communities. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
The creative team behind Broadway's Spider-Man has had a tough year. Technical difficulties, actor injuries, and multiple delays of the opening night. Finally, last week, after months of previews, critics gave up waiting and published their reviews, and Spider-Man got panned. We asked NPR's Bob Mondello to check out this work in progress and tell us what patrons are seeing for as much as $275 a seat.
Let's start with something that sort of works. Near the end of the first act, there's a flying sequence that lasts maybe 2 minutes. The Green Goblin, a bad guy, has been hooked into a harness and is swinging over the heads of the folks in the expensive seats. This is not thrilling. In fact, it's getting a little old. Spidey's done it a couple of times to no particular effect. But this time, when Spidey joins the Goblin up there, director Julie Taymor has him do something he has not done before, to surprised woos from the crowd, he lands in a tense crouch in the theater aisle. Spidey has touched down. Now, notice this is not a musical moment created by Bono and the Edge. It has nothing to do with the show's striking but flat set design. It's not even about the aerial work, which for the most part will not make your Spidey sense tingle. What's getting the audience worked up is a performer coming down to earth nearby. It's the thing theater can do that movies can't, put you close to a live actor. And suddenly, you're not thinking about wires and harnesses, but about knee joints and tendons. Flying is mechanical, landing takes skill, and in live theater, when it's happening right next to you, you immediately get the difference. See how the boy falls from the sky. Something else that works best when it's down to earth is the script. Spidey versus Green Goblin? Clear. Spidey crazy for girlfriend Mary Jane? Clear. Spidey's relationship with great-great-great spiritual second cousin Arachne, spider lady creature of Greek myth? Less clear, though you can sort of follow it. I get why Taymor, who is a classical theater buff, wants to bring in something non-comic booky, but she's kind of trying too hard. A geek chorus of four kids second-guessing plot twists? First act playground bullies who morph into a second act military-industrial complex? A weird fixation on bad guy fashions and spider high heels? Throw all that at a web and things are bound to get tangled, even when the lyrics are clear.
You can change your mind, but you cannot change your heart. It's a compass and a map, the key to...
Lyrics, let's note, are not this show's strong suit. What Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark wants to be is a theme park. Oddly, a $65 million theme park where patrons only get to watch other people ride the rides. Still, I caught the first performance after the critics weighed in, and this is hardly high praise, but the show's not nearly the train wreck I'd expected. I've seen theatrical train wrecks. Annie 2, Home Sweet Homer, the Earth, Wind & Fire musical Hot Feet. This is just a train that takes forever to get out of the station and up to speed. Almost 3 hours? Come on, it's based on a comic book. A child could cut it. Get rid of the third and fourth choruses of every song, since they don't advance lyrically or build to climaxes. When there's a visual effect that works, like a forced perspective building painted on a ramp so Spidey can crawl up it, let us see it once, not five times. Yes, it was expensive to build, but each time it pops up, it works less well. Junk the film montage in Act 2, keep the flying, and even keep that gal Arachne, though she probably doesn't need quite so many costume changes. Just get the whole thing down to 85 snappy minutes. It'll still be junk, but it'll be efficient commercial junk, like those $40 t-shirts in the lobby. And if Taymor and company are serious about working to fix it, they've still got lots of time before the opening date she likes better than the one the critics chose, March 15, the Ides of March. Because that worked so well for Caesar? I'm Bob Mondello.
Down in the wild swamps off the coast of southwest Florida, tucked in among the sawgrass and mangrove tunnels, is a fictional family-run theme park. It's called Swamplandia, and it bills itself as the number one gator-themed park and swamp cafe. In Karen Russell's debut novel, also called Swamplandia, the narrator Ava Bigtree describes the main attraction, her mother, Hylola Bigtree, diving into a pit of alligators by starlight.
Like black silk, the water bunched and wrinkled. Her arms rode hard. You could hear her breaststrokes ripping at the water, her gasps for air. Now and then a pair of coal-red eyes snagged at the white net of the spotlight as the chief rolled it over the pit. 3 long minutes passed, then 4, and at last she gasped mightily and grasped the ladder rails on the eastern side of the stage. We all exhaled with her. Our stage wasn't much, just a simple cypress board on 6-foot stilts, suspended over the gator pit. She climbed out of the lake. Her trembling arms folded over the dimple of her belly button. She spat water, gave a little wave. The crowd went crazy.
That's 29-year-old novelist Karen Russell reading from Swamplandia. And Karen, we should say it's Swamplandia with an exclamation point after it, not just Swamplandia.
That's right. I really wanted to keep that exclamation point, as doofy as it probably seems. But something about the exclamation point, it just seems like the right punctuation for the whole novel, you know, because so much of their park is engineered enthusiasm, you know, this engineered fantasy, and it's really powered by their belief in themselves. You know, they're sort of in the tradition of self-invented American families. They became the Big Tree Tribe. So even though there's no Miccosukee or Seminole blood in them, the father of this family, Chief Big Tree, tells his children, well, we're our own Indians. So it's sort of a, you know, they're in good company in South Florida, where there are a lot of pastless people kind of reinventing themselves.
That's their story, and they're sticking to it.
That's their story, and they're selling it for profit, too.
Well, by page 7 of the book, the mother, Hylola, who we just heard about, diving into that lake of alligators, has died of cancer, ovarian cancer, and the family, which is 3 children and the husband, the chief, are all blown in different directions. The son, Kiwi, is on the mainland. The 2 other children, the older sister, Osceola, starts communicating with the dead and is possessed by ghosts and disappears. And then it's up to Ava, the narrator, who's 13 years old, to try to find her, going out on a skiff through these swamps, trying to find the underworld with this really, really creepy guy, the Birdman.
Right. Doesn't that sound... It's such a difficult novel to paraphrase. It just sounds insane.
There's
every time,
every time
I hear it paraphrased. I mean, it was difficult during the years of drafting to explain to people what I was up to. You know, you either got a kind blank face or a face of horror, you know, when I would try to describe what this book was about.
Well, Karen, let's talk about the tone here, because it starts out, and clearly from the way you're describing it, part of it is this sort of rollicking burlesque with sort of shades of another great Florida writer, Carl Hiaasen, and then it takes this very, very dark turn, sort of a gothic turn.
I think the original seed of the idea was that it was going to be sort of a this underworld journey staged in the backwaters of the Everglades, which to me have always looked, you know, it just seems like an appropriate setting because the swamp is an absolutely uncanny place. It's neither sea nor land. There are these mangrove tunnels that really do feel like something out of Dante, you know, and the sawgrass prairies that just go on limitlessly. So it's a really, it has a haunted feeling if you go there. And it does feel sort of like anything could happen.
You also had to try to figure out, because these are alligator wrestlers, a lot about just how strong an alligator's jaws are and how you would get your foot out of an alligator's mouth if you needed to.
Right. No hands-on research really here beyond feeding a Purdue drumstick to a gator at Gatorland.
Nice.
That was about as close as I got. No, I was pretty terrified just doing that. And part of the reason I was terrified is it turns out an alligator can close its jaws with 2,125 pounds per square inch, which is about the force of a guillotine. But the muscular that opens those same jaws is extremely weak. So that's sort of what alligator wrestlers are exploiting. If you can get your fist around an alligator's jaws, if you can even get a girl's goody hair elastic around their jaws, they won't be able to open them.
Karen, what were your influences when you were a young reader, reading books, letting your imagination go wild? What kinds of worlds were you discovering in books that you knew you loved?
I think I was a pretty omnivorous reader. If you put like a Pepperidge Farm box in front of me, I would read that, you know, anything that kind of came my way. I had this bargain with my mom that we would go to the library, and if I read, you know, like a kiddie version of Jane Eyre or sort of a classically vetted author, then I could get a Stephen King book. And I really think that diet has influenced everything I've written since, sort of, you know, this whatever food pyramid we cobbled together. And I loved both. I mean, I really loved these sort of lyrical, realist stories. And I definitely probably listed towards the weirder books. And I was an anxious kid, so it was such a pleasure to have, you know, this little door you could carry around with you and just open in whatever situation you found yourself. You know, sort of like this really convenient rabbit hole you could carry around with you.
An anxious kid, but it sounds like you also gravitated towards some scary stuff.
Yeah, I think that's probably why, you know. And I think that this occurs in this book, too, where Chief Big Tree really wants to create a beautiful fiction, a fantasy for his children, but they are so rocked by grief at the loss of their mother and sort of other depressing and terrifying realities that have found their way onto the island So I think kids are really alert to all kinds of darkness, you know, and sorrow. I think that they're actually like raw nerves in the world a lot of the time. And so to find a way privately to reckon with some of the forces that you know exist, but you're young, you don't maybe have the vocabulary to talk about them, or, you know, you're not going to be taken seriously if you try to bring them up, or those concerns get squelched. I think the literature was really sort of a private world where, you know, talk about communicating with the dead, right? That was always incredible to me as a young reader, and still, you know, that you can read a book by a decades-dead author that articulates so beautifully something you've always suspected. It was a real antidote to loneliness for me when I was a young reader.
Karen Russell is the author of the debut novel Swamplandia, with an exclamation point. Karen, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
And you can read the beginning of Swamplandia at npr.org. 1 month to go till Mardi Gras, which means the Mardi Gras Indians in New Orleans are in the final stages of sewing their outrageously elaborate costumes, extravaganzas of feathers, rhinestones, and beads. And this year, some of the Indians hope they'll be able to share in the profits from photos sold of them after the parades. They're filing for copyright protection for those costumes. We're going to hear about the legal basis for that in a few minutes, but first to one of the Indian chiefs, Howard Miller of the Creole Wild West Mardi Gras Indians, who joins me from New Orleans. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
And Chief Miller, let's explain. These suits are custom made every year, hand sewn. Why don't you, if you can, give us a preview of yours?
Well, you know, every year we take out to sew these suits. It takes us 9 months, a whole year to complete them. They're handmade. And the suit itself is a mystery until I'm up here Mardi Gras Day.
Mm-hmm.
But I has been working diligent on this here, and I'm getting it together. I don't want to give away anything about what I may be wearing this year.
I didn't think you would.
But I'll be there, and I hope all will be there to see me.
We should explain that the Mardi Gras Indians are an old tradition among Black New Orleanians, and there would be lots of photographs after the Mardi Gras of the parades in books and in posters. And this, I gather, is sort of at the root of what you feel is a level of exploitation. Can you explain that?
Yes. For years, we have been feel that we have been exploited. They have been taking advantage of us and coming in and snapping pictures and selling the pictures. We see them everywhere, magazine, even in art galleries being sold, and we are not getting anything from it. And luckily, we found this nice lady, Miss Ashley Keaton, to take part in and try to do something about that for us. And so far, she has been successful in doing that.
Well, let's bring Ashley into the conversation. This is Ashley Keaton of Tulane Law School, the lawyer who's been working on this with you. And Ashley, how do these costumes, these suits that the Mardi Gras Indians are wearing, come under copyright protection? How would that work?
Well, they fall under copyright protection as works of art, as sculptures, because the designs are sewn onto canvas and other materials, and they are worn not as costumes, but they're worn over clothing. So they're not functional, which qualifies them for copyright protection as a sculptural work of art pursuant to the Copyright Act.
And how would this work in practice? If someone were to take a picture, say, of a Mardi Gras Indian wearing a copyrighted suit, then what?
Well, it depends. If the photograph depicts the suit as the primary focus of the subject matter, then I would argue that would qualify as a derivative work. Let's say someone takes a photograph of Chief Howard's suit and they're selling it in commerce. Well, then he's got recourse in a court of law.
Hmm. Chief Miller, what would you hope after this year's Mardi Gras parades? What would you hope might be different for you and the tribe?
Well, I just would hope that if we are exploited, then we could be compensated for it. Because it's a lot goes into the suits, time, hour, blood, sweat, tears, money. And so it is only fair that I think that we should be able to be compensated. Someone else is going to be paid for it.
So you're not talking about just your average tourist lining a Mardi Gras parade route. You're talking about maybe a calendar or a poster book or something like that.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. We have no problem with people taking pictures for education purposes, for, you know, if you wanted to take a picture for your private, you know, you have in your home. It's no problem with that. It's just if you want to take it to make money, then that's where we say we should be also compensated. And I think that's fair.
Chief Miller, good luck with sewing the rest of your costume. Have a great Mardi Gras. And Ashley Keaton, thanks to you, too.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for having us.
Thank you.
That's Howard Miller, chief of the Creole Wild West Mardi Gras Indians. We also spoke with Ashley Keaton of Tulane Law School.
couple of months ago, we took our program out to L.A., where Beto Arcos happens to reside. Beto hosts the music program called Global Village on KPFK. Anyway, he took us to some of the best taco trucks in the city and tipped us off to some of his favorite new Mexican music, including work by this artist you're hearing. His name is Ernesto Anaya. This track is off Anaya's debut album, and though we're not in L.A. this weekend, Beto is, with a whole bunch of amazing new music from Mexico. Beto, great to have you back.
Great to talk to you, Guy.
Now, I know you mentioned Ernesto Anaya before, that he's sort of one of the best-known instrumentalists in Mexico, and this is actually off his debut record, I guess a sort of homage to a kind of traditional style of Mexican music.
The style of music is called Son Huasteco, and it's better known in Mexico as Huapango. Hmm. It's this festive, joyful, exciting music from the northeastern part of Mexico, an area that comprises about six or seven different states. It's roots music. It's the equivalent of bluegrass to Mexico because it's from the mountains, and it's very festive, and it's danceable, and it's just great music, very soulful. No lo dejo que sucumba, mi ánimo no se quebranta. Mi ánimo no se quebranta.
Beto, why did Ernesto Anaya wait so long to record his own record if he's sort of been around and worked with so many other artists for so long?
You know, I asked him this very question a couple months ago, and he says, look, I'm really busy. I've been, you know, I don't have any time to do my own stuff because everybody wants me to play with them. You know, he's recorded with everybody in Mexican music, and he's recorded for film, soundtracks, and so on. So basically it was all about, you know, how much time he had to put into this record. So the record really took a couple of years for him to finally finish it.
Beto, what an amazing piece. You've got a new selection from someone else now. A lot of people consider this artist to be, I guess, Mexican music royalty.
I've been listening to her for as long as I can remember. This is a song called Tierra Brava, or Brave Land, by Eugenia León. ¿Qué me va usted a comprar? Traigo flores de caña y el girasol. She's so deep and soulful and just really exciting to see on stage. She's a fantastic vocalist, and she can sing anything you want. She'll sing boleros, rancheras, bossa novas, cha-cha-chas. This is sort of a cha-cha-cha music. I think a lot of people forget sometimes that Mexico has a Caribbean side to it. Mm. And this is that kind of music from the Caribbean, from Veracruz.
I'm speaking with Beto Arcos. He's the host of KPFK's Global Village, and he brought us a stack of records in honor of the 200th anniversary of Mexico's independence. Is that right? Are we doing this in honor of Mexico's independence?
Yes, we are. In fact, the big date is really September 15, when everybody at 11 p.m., you know, screams their heart out and celebrates Mexicanness, if you will, around the world too. Whatever Mexicans are. All you need is a bottle of tequila and some good Mexican music, and that's it.
Well, you brought some good stuff. And this next one, we've talked about her before. She is the legendary, and I should add to what she's, 91-year-old Chavela Vargas.
Yes, indeed. She just turned 91 in April, and this is, in fact, a celebration of her life with friends. It's an album of duets.
What a voice, Beto. I mean, you can hear the age, obviously, the experience, but it's still so powerful.
Guy, when I listen to Chavela Vargas, I'm sorry to say, but I cry. I mean, this is the blues. You know, this is the Mexican blues. This is the stuff.
And this this record is actually a personal narrative, a personal story about herself. And she's had so many ups and downs in her career. I mean, she basically battled and tackled her alcoholism in her 80s, in her late 80s, right?
That's right. There's a great story that I like to tell. See if I can make it brief. She showed up at the funeral of José Alfredo Jiménez, the father of Canción Ranchera, and she sang all his songs that she knew before his coffin all night, and just sang and sang. She had a bottle of tequila next to her, and she sang and sang and sang because she just couldn't bear to let him go. And yes, she battled, she disappeared for years and years, and then somebody found her in a club one day, and pretty soon it was Pedro Almodóvar who kind of helped her bring her back.
The Spanish director, obviously. That's
right. If I were to tell anybody, you need to have some Mexican music, I would say, please get Chabela Vargas.
Finally, Beto, you have some music that you brought from a 16-piece band from the Oaxaca region in Mexico. Who are they?
This is Banda Regional Mije. Their new record is called Remijes, and this piece is a traditional piece called Los Huenches.
Okay, this starts out, you know, a bit like a march, but then it turns this really sharp corner about a minute into the song. It almost sounds like a Balkan gypsy band.
Funny you should say that, because they did a concert with the Mahali Rai Banda, this fantastic band from Macedonia. Yeah, so yes, this is exactly the idea. There are these brass bands in Mexico, just like there are in the Balkans, that got attention by this American musician, Stephen Brown. He went up to this little village in Oaxaca and discovered the big park in the middle of the town, and he saw that there were, you know, brass musicians playing, and he just was so moved and touched, and he wanted to do something interesting with them. He wanted to get them to improvise a little, and they taught the musicians, in a sense, how to play freer. And so they are playing, in a sense, traditional music with a jazz approach, if you will. They're reinventing their own traditional music, and it's just fantastic.
It's such fun music.
Yes, it is.
That's Beto Arcos. He pops in from time to time to talk about some of the music he's spinning on his show. It's called Global Village, and you can hear it on KPFK in Los Angeles. Beto, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Guy.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to NPR's arts channel at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Netta Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.